We might as well admit it, America is becoming an emotional wreck. Why this is, I will leave to historians for now. Although I made fun of myself the other day on a podcast and in the Tribune column about This Is Us, a good show that makes us all want to cry. Of course, as fates would have it, as I sat and cried and ate ice cream and cried, Zeus the Wonder Dog ran into a skunk. The smell of it all triggered me. I ran to my safe space. I left my poor wife to deal with it. John Cass, pajama boy, I am the modern American man you are waiting for. Okay, I'll take my tongue from my cheek, finally, and still we want to cry. Satire or not, sarcasm or not, at least millions of us search out vehicles to trigger it. It's all rather self-indulgent, yes, and it speaks about our culture and what's wrong with it. The Bible tells us, when I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. Then again, what is this thing called man? And now gripped by emotion, we act childishly. For some, it's pounding on the doors of the Supreme Court. For others, it's shrieking at conservatives in restaurants or shouting down ideas that challenge us at universities where we are supposed to be challenged, but no longer, apparently. And you can see this emotional frenzy reflected in our policy debates. A mass of illegal immigrants will arrive at our borders soon, and either they're stopped and will become emotional at their sorrow and cry, or we let them in and say to hell with borders. And the murder in Turkey of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist, Washington Post journalist and critic of the Saudi regime, makes us emotional too. I've seen journalists react this way emotionally with Iran in play and Yemen, and they use it to pound Trump. But I'm thinking we should take a step back. And we will, and think like adults with our special guest, Professor Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, an expert on politics, foreign policy, and the collapse of norms at our university. And my buddy, co-host of this podcast, Jeff Carlin, WGN producer of the Rokan Show with Anna DeVolantis, and the man who had Senator Elizabeth Warren singing from Annie Get Your Gun in the last episode. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, pajama boy, sitting on the couch crying. And you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
At the beginning of this podcast, I told you that sometimes we have to put away childish things. That might include emotion sometimes, giving into emotion and stepping back and actually using that part of our brain that's not associated with the medulla, but the other parts that involve thinking. And our guest, I'm proud to say, is Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, author of many books, and columnist at Real Clear Politics. You hear him on television and radio all the time. And he's our guest. Good morning, sir.
It's great to talk with you, John. I love your columns. I really do.
Thank you, Charles. Professor, one of the things I mentioned in the monologue was we become very emotional about so much now, and I'll leave historians like you to deal with the reasons why. But when it comes to foreign policy and life, the life and death of nation states, I would much rather we not be as emotional. And it brings me to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi national journalist, critic of the regime in Saudi Arabia, and also murdered in Turkey. I mean, in Turkey, in the Saudi consulate, or the, I think, in Ankara or Istanbul. At a time when Saudi is undergoing incredible change, regime change, a ruthless boss. Iran is in play. A lot of different, Yemen is in play. There are a lot of different interests that are colliding.
Convergence of interests, for right. sure.
And so I'd much rather not, like some of the journalists that I've seen, including colleagues, who are using it just as a Trump-bashing exercise, to think in terms of what does this mean? And what does it mean when we become emotional, Professor, and think in terms of good and evil and murder and so forth in the realm of nation states where thousands are being killed, Iran especially, Saudi, Yemen especially. We focus on one thing, one emotional story to make a point, and I don't know if we're being driven to that point.
Do you remember those 10 p.m. news casts in the 70s with, it's Bill Curtis,
yeah.
you know, and... They said, if it bleeds, it leads, and it's still true. The mere fact that there is video of this makes a big difference. And I'll tell you something. I looked at the – I subscribe online to the Washington Post, and I looked at it today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they it's just all over their front page. I mean, they take this very seriously. And for understandable reasons, I think you raise a really fascinating question about emotions and foreign policy. And if I can be a little professorial,
that's why you're here, man.
For a minute. Modern mass politics began in the 1870s, roughly, in Britain as they were expanding the electorate. And believe it or not, it was also involved Turkey. Then the Ottoman Empire, and they were fighting the Russians, and there's an area along the Black Sea between Russia and then Constantinople that's now Romania, Bulgaria, and so forth, and that was a contested area between the two, and the Ottomans in defending the area went in and massacred huge numbers of Bulgarians. British reporters, and by now you had mass circulation newspapers that were inexpensive and spun off on steam-driven presses. So this was not like a century earlier. There were reporters there and so forth. And they came in and actually saw piles of skulls of women and children that had been massacred by the Ottomans. Okay? I don't have to tell somebody who's proud of his Greek heritage what could happen in these kind of conflicts.
Older skulls.
Right, right. And there was a political campaign going on in England between Gladstone and Disraeli. And Gladstone made a whistle-stop tour, the first one probably, and had written a pamphlet, short book. He was a very learned man, and called The Bulgarian Horrors. And he was saying, we cannot deal with the Ottomans. And Disraeli, his opponent, was a realist who said, look, our basic interest in the area is to prevent Russian expansion, and because we're still in India, the Raj, we want to have secure ally in the Eastern Mediterranean, and those are the Ottomans. So it's bad what happened, but we don't want to jettison our ally. And I'm struck, here we are, 150 years later, same exact issue, right? Where, and if the United States were a dictatorship, we could do what Putin does. He backs his guy in Syria with barrel bombs on civilian areas. But the American public won't tolerate that. To give you a little background, we traditionally had backed the Saudis against the mullahs in Iran since the revolution in 79. President Obama changed that.
Yes, he did.
And Trump
Shia
has changed.
All the way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it hit the fan.
Right.
And the fact is, Trump had changed it back, and they made a real commitment to the Saudis. The Saudis have always been a brutal dictatorship. What's different now, besides a headstrong young leader, he's not formally the leader. He's number two, but he's really running things.
Right.
Right. And what he's done is he's looked down the pipeline 10, 15 years and said, look, the world is moving away from its dependence upon Saudi hydrocarbons. And what we've been doing now, our whole budget is based on oil revenues. Half of our PhDs are more trained in Islam and the Quran rather than being engineers and scientists. And we pay off all of our political opponents. We just pay them off. And this is not going to continue to work. We have to make a transformation. And when you do that, the losers are unhappy. So what you've got now is the Turks have this brilliant opportunity. They've been against the Saudis and Mohammed bin Salman. And they're basically allied with Iran.
Playing with Russia.
Exactly. Right. And so what you have is this has just been handed to them on a silver platter, John. What I expect will happen is the U.S. does not want to sever this relationship because then in the Persian Gulf we have no one. And so I think what you'll see is more than a wrist slap, but something less than a full-on thing. And what the Turks will try to do is pin the tail on the donkey, which is to make clear that the guy who is really behind this goes all the way to the top.
And this is what you just laid out is markedly different from the kind of cheap emotional analysis or side shots that I see on Twitter from some of my colleagues and also that I hear on broadcast, Jeff Garlin. And I wonder, when you are, as a producer covering this stuff and leading into the news and you hear it and people say, oh, Khashoggi, oh, Trump loves the Saudis, and it's reduced to that form, are we actually helping our nation, people, our countrymen, come to some kind of understanding of what the complexities are? Or are we falling into the bobbing corks on the sea as we're being herded this way and that?
Well, I mean,
don't you love when I lead the...
John, when you go from bobbing corks to herding, I think...
I know,
well,
mixing my metaphors. I didn't even throw any food in.
Yeah, there are cows swimming out there,
yeah,
my friend.
Right, okay.
Pigs,
okay.
Too.
All right.
You always give me the softballs. I love it, John.
Thanks, John.
From our
man who can get Liz Warren to sing I Am an Indian Too on my podcast...
That's right.
Deserves it.
Yeah. Well, for our purposes, for me, Ro and Anna, and what we do it from a tactician point. What do we know? Why do we know it? And a lot of that has been we go to people, former FBI guys who have dealt with this, who worked the bin Laden desk,
yes.
Who, CIA guys who worked Syria, reporters on the ground in Istanbul. And that's how we cover it. We don't go down the rabbit hole of, oh, well, we think this mind is like this or this person thinking this.
This is not a rabbit hole. We're trying to lay out the please, I don't mean to be – no, Betty will accuse me
no.
That I've been rude to you, and I don't mean to be. But also, what all these actors, in my mind, maybe I'm wrong, the actors, when they speak, Professor, I hear actors speak on this topic, I always think of who said in politics there are no permanent enemies, no permanent friends.
Palmerston, who was the British Prime Minister in the 1850s, and he says that Britain had no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, only permanent interests. The problem is, and he was in many ways one of the very first sort of mass market politicians. People loved him in England, and he built on that. Henry Kissinger, in his memoirs, or in one of his books, talked about how difficult it was to be a true realist, that is, a Machiavellian in a democracy, because you do have to root your policies in public support. The problem, I think Trump, let me go back, let me go to the president. I think what you're doing in terms of sort of who's on first, who's on second, can this guy steal third, is exactly what reporting is and should be. I'm trying to talk with about these issues as if I'm more in Theo Epstein's position of what kind of team are you putting together? So there's a difference between the tactics day to day and even sort of game management through this week and next week with the kind of strategy you put together for the team over the long haul. And I think you need to keep both in mind. You need to have your strategy and your tactics need to conform to each other. The problem that the United States has in that region, the most fundamental problem, is that the region is basically unstable. And it is vital because of the oil, not that we, the United States, need, but that the whole world needs. It's an unstable region. And we have a fundamental foe in the region, Iran. And I think Trump, the basic way to understand Trump, and I think he's been misunderstood, he is an emotional guy, and so forth. I think the basic way to understand Trump is that he's a tactician and a negotiator. So if Trump, we're sitting three or four blocks from the Trump Tower in Chicago. If Trump came to you, John, and said, John, I know you own some land next to the Trump Tower, and I know you want to put up a parking lot there, a parking structure. And I absolutely hate the idea of a parking structure, and I would not tolerate a parking structure even if you offered me $40 million. And what I hear from the newscasters is Trump doesn't want parking structure. Trump opposes parking structure. And what you and I would hear, I think, is wonder what he'd do if you offered him 45.
Yeah. Well, I did see a quote. The world loathes what Trump says, but they pay deep attention to the new credible threats of economic and military coercion, said Charles Lipson, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Chicago.
They loathe what he says, but they pay attention to what he's doing.
But in one of your books, I don't have the title with me, but the book that centers on how democracies don't go to war.
It's called Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace.
Well, we can see Erdogan,
yep.
A populist,
illiberal
boss of Turkey,
yep.
Populist, building on a sort of fundamental political structure. Actually, I know this. I've been there and studied it myself, and I read press reports. Built on a sort of the democratic machine politics of Chicago, where the fundamentalists started serving and helping people with their daily tasks, building up power bases. He took it over and became this huge populist who we thought at one time wanted the caliphate in Turkey.
Well, I think if he could get it, he'd take it. And I think his goal has been to move toward an Islamic-oriented state, but to do it step by step rather than in one fell swoop. And the key to doing this is getting rid of the military, a professional military.
The Kemalists.
Right. And the term deep state, which you now hear, and it's troubling not only to hear it in America, but because it's right,
yes,
was a term that was invented in Turkey.
Yes, it was.
And Ataturk, who formed the secularist regime in Turkey after World War I, actually, he would have been fine with a caliphate, but he was sort of cut off at the knees by the religious leaders, and so he went secular. And he created a military as a kind of ballast for that regime. And every time it would kind of veer off course, the military would come in and restore it to this kind of secularist, authoritarian, but kind of mildly so regime. Now, in Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood took over with Obama's support after Mubarak was overthrown. When there was risings against Mubarak, the United States cut him off within 2 weeks. And the Saudis looked at that and were petrified.
Right. We're next.
Right, we're next. And we count on the Americans, and the Americans will cut us loose, at least under Obama, they thought, very quickly. And the people who came in and won the first election, because they were the only organized group, were the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood was almost immediately trying to do what Erdogan was doing in Turkey. But as they slowly got rid of all the generals who were the key behind Mubarak and Sadat before him and Nasser before him, they could see that if we wait another 6, 8, 10 months, none of us are going to be here. They're all going to be replaced by loyalists to the Muslim Brotherhood. That's when they created the coup that was backed by the public, which was unhappy. There were millions sure. in the street. So what you see is they did it at the last possible moment that they thought they could do it. So it's a very unstable region. And what you see with Trump is really, for all the flailing of arms, who been the U.S. allies in the region? Traditionally, it was Iran. That hadn't been true since the revolution in Iran in 79. Turkey, Egypt, Israel. And what you see for all the flailing of hands is gradually Trump and his team putting that old coalition back together as best they can, given difficult circumstances.
Just an aside to readers,
yep.
Often, for those of you who read the column, I often refer to people in Washington as the Kemalists. And it's really nonpartisan. Okay, but there are those who play a back game and will continue to do so. Jeff, again, lest anyone, particularly Christine and your mom and anyone, think that I was being, brushing that off. I was not. I think that it is critically important to get people on the ground reporting on this. So what's the latest? What's going to be the latest on this? Anybody know? I haven't followed it in the last few days.
Oh, I mean, I don't know what the latest will be by the time we get this up, but I know there are theories out there. I mean, there are theories that the Turks are are essentially, they're in it for a payout. They knew this was coming. They knew they had this opportunity, and they're waiting for a big chunk of change to come from the Saudis. That's one of the working theories. The other theory is that this gentleman who died suspiciously in a car crash.
The one that Professor Lipson had on his, I saw.
Who could have imagined?
Right. This was one of the experts of chopping bodies.
Right.
And died. He came in with his group.
Mm-hmm. One of the 15 that flew in the dead of night, stayed for less than 24 hours and were out the door. And supposedly he's the one who said, let's not do this here. This is not a good place to do this. Let's do this somewhere else.
One of the people at this in this podcast suggested, where else would you roll over a body 15 times? I think it wasn't me and it wasn't Jeff. I think it was you, right? You were kind of being a smart ass on it.
Yeah. There was a phrase, and I'm trying to remember who, I can't remember who said it. This is what Google is for.
Right.
But this is worse than a crime. It's a mistake. And, you know, it's both. The fact is, when you put yourself in a position where the Turks and the Iranians can be the human rights figures in the debate, you are really in bad shape.
I would pose a question. So the Davos in the deserts is happening or is going to be happening. And
stock market went down because some people didn't go.
Right. And so is that enough? Are these financial groups, these financial leaders not going in here and saying, hey, you know what? You guys screwed the pooch. We're not going to be involved. Deal with it. Is that enough of a slap on the wrist? Because, you said that there's got to be something, and is this it?
My dog Lola hates that reference to screw the pooch. I just want you to know. I'm speaking on behalf of dogs everywhere.
Sure.
I think what you might see, what you're going to see, is a holding action. So, and I don't know what it'll be, but I could see we're going to hold off the sale of the military parts, which were kind of exaggerated anyway. But we're going to do an evaluation of that. That evaluation will be over after the election.
Sure.
You can see a bunch of things like that. But remember, there is a real possibility that with Venezuela in such trouble, its oil is off the line. There are sanctions that are coming in the next few weeks against Iran, and its oil will be off international markets. This will put tremendous upward pressure on oil prices. We had been counting on the Saudis to increase production. They would want to do that for their own purposes anyway, to put pressure on Iran, which will be selling oil secretly to China and North Korea and so forth anyway. But it's going to be hard to ask the Saudis to do things while you're sort of punching them in the nose on the other hand. What I expect to see is a change-up pitch. That is, they'll try to appear to the American public, the batter, as if it's coming in at 98 miles an hour. In fact, I suspect it'll be coming in at 78.
One thing I caution everybody, I don't have to caution those who listen to this podcast. But remember, anytime when it's Chicago politics, which is, I'm immersed in this, I can see who's reporting what, who's saying what. And because I've been doing this for 30 years, I know who may have been talking to whom to get this story out there. And that's how I think, because I think in terms of interests, I was trained that way, and it served me well. The same thing with this. There is a lot of money at stake. Jeff, you mentioned not going to the Davos in
the desert.
The desert. That drove the market down. Professor Lipson just said will drive the prices up. Think in terms of
oil prices.
Yeah, just don't be a chumbalone about all this and get all emotional. I'm sorry the man is dead, but our country is bigger than one man's death. I'm sorry. Our foreign policy has to be thought of, in my mind. What about dictatorships and double standards?
I agree with you, but our foreign policy has to have a kind of broad support. It can't lead to a kind of broad revulsion.
Correct.
In the public, and especially when there's video and the rest, and right. The guy's a columnist.
Yeah, and he's a columnist for the Post.
Now, what you will see coming out is that this guy had close associations, actually, with Osama bin Laden. We already know a bit of that. With the Muslim Brotherhood, you'll see a lot more of that. There'll be leaks that are designed to dirty him up.
His uncle was an arms dealer. And
for a reason.
Right.
Well, they'll be designed to dirty him up for a reason.
Right.
Well,
right.
I suspect that the people at NSA, CIA, DIA, all the initials, will be trying to figure out what happened. I think we are beginning to understand what happened. But the deep games that everybody else is playing, but the public won't understand or care. What they'll care about is two things. Does our policy broadly in the area sort of sicken them at their stomach? And secondly, are there real consequences for the United States? And I think what try to see is a policy that sort of kicks the can down the road a bit so that it doesn't sicken Americans at their stomach. So that's why I'm saying we'll do something, but I think not punch the Saudis in the nose. You'll see the Turks and the Iranians leaking out more information designed to put pressure on the Americans to do more. And then you'll see the administration in Washington trying to avoid putting us at odds with the Saudis because we have real interests, as you, John, are saying, and as I think you're reporting, Jeff, in the area. It's not quite the 7-10 split in bowling, but we are left with a sort of difficult situation, and we don't want to just bowl the ball right down the center and hit nothing.
I'd say that I could leave the discussion there on that subject, but I have other questions to ask Professor Lipson. We were talking on the phone a couple days ago about the absence of norms in academic and basically our public life. We're becoming more emotional of a people. We get very emotional over television shows. We pound on the gates of the Supreme Court. We scream at the at people, at senators, etc. What is going on with our country, with our culture right now?
It's really disturbing to all of us who believe in democracy. Democracy ultimately depends upon a notion that the other side is the loyal opposition. When one side kneels at the flag, the other side says they're not just the opposition, they're disloyal. And then the people who are kneeling say, look, we've got real objections, and the people who fail to hear those objections are trying to squash our right to protest, which is a First Amendment right and very fundamental. So I'm not trying to sort of take a particular side in this. I have my views. But what you are seeing is, I think, so what's at stake here? Well, we know what's at stake. What's driving it? I would say the following. The first thing is, I think we the whole system is set up as a two-party system. And that's not just our culture. It's the nature of what's called a first-past-the-post system of elections. So if you think about third-party candidates, even ones that got a fair amount of the vote, 20% or something like Ross Perot. Or George Wallace, or any of these groups, what happens to them in the next election? Nothing. They're gone. And what happens to them in Congress? Nothing. They're gone. Because basically, unless you start, even if you get 20%, unless you get more than 50% in a congressional district or get a plurality in a congressional district or a state, you don't have any senators or representatives. It's a two-party system. In a two-party system that is no longer controlled in smoke-filled rooms, right? Not that you could smoke in any room, but...
only with Dan Proft. And I noticed that I had a cigar, but I noticed when Charles Lipson was on with Dan, he did not have a cigar.
No, yeah. I drove too many long trips with my grandfather and a friend named Nat Katz smoking bad cigars. And I felt like I ingested enough bad cigars forever.
So we should have a parliamentary system?
What happens is we have primaries, and the primaries are controlled by the most activated voters, and those are further to the left on the Democratic Party and to the right on the Republican Party. There used to be, in effect, a third party in America. It didn't have that name, but they were the Southern Democrats. And they kept the Democratic Party more toward the center because these people were essentially very conservative. Many of them were racist segregationists. Mm-hmm. And there was a liberal wing in the Republican Party.
Rockefeller.
Yeah, exactly. And these guys are all gone. They're all gone. All in the South, they're all Republicans, those Southern Democrats. And in the Northeast, I think there's only one Republican congressman, and he's endangered in Maine right now. But if you look at congressional voting in the Senate, the most liberal Republican senator is Susan Collins. The most conservative Democratic senator is Joe Manchin by voting records. Right. And they don't even overlap. That is, they are literally two pots that if you think of old Venn diagrams where there's where the two circles overlap, there's no overlap.
So?
And when you if you ran against Trump in a Republican primary this year, unless you were dating teenage girls or something, right. The fact is, Trump has got complete control, but the party was moving to the right, the Democrats moving sharply to the left, and under those circumstances, and what's at stake? There's one more big thing that's at stake, and it's been really misunderstood in the fight, I think, over Kavanaugh. The Kavanaugh fight, to the extent that people talked about issues at all, they talked about Roe v. Wade, right? And that's a very important issue for many people, of course. But there's one other big issue, which is the administrative state. To use a name from the past, we're being governed increasingly by Lois Lerners all over the place.
Hence Kamalists, hence the bureaucrats of
right.
the empire. Right.
Now, why is that happening? And the answer is that, first, the federal government has taken on more and more and more activities. If the government is funding student scholarships, even though no money goes into athletics, they can tell you whether your athletic programs are balanced between men and women. And if you don't balance them the way some mid-level bureaucrat wants, then they will cut off money not to the sports programs. University of Michigan gets no money for its sports programs. They cut it off to the sciences. They cut it off for student loans. So, and if and the Congress passes these laws, and they can't pass detailed laws. They say, we want clean water. And then they leave it up to a bureaucracy to say what that means. Now, what the bureaucracy does is not only pass...
They write law.
They write laws, but they do more. They write the law, that's the legislation. They execute the law, that's the executive branch. And then if you have a problem with it, their courts inside, they adjudicate it. So this is all three branches together, and they're opaque. So you and look, if you want to know what how bureaucracies protect themselves, look at the Catholic Church over time and the problem of priest abuse. Until that was exposed by outsiders, so somebody once asked me, how did the priests think they could get away with this? And I said, 2,000 years of experience. Do you think this stuff started happening 20, 30 years ago? Of course not. It's been happening for a long time. Did these priests ever get booted out? No, they were just circulated around. Bureaucracies don't police themselves. They protect themselves. And you see that in the CIA, you see it in the IRS, and in every other, in the Bureau of Land Management, and now we're being governed by these people.
But what Kavanaugh represents, as you know, is his work, his body of work, is about attacking that administrative state.
Exactly. You brought it back to the point that I was rambling around.
Sorry,
thank
no,
you,
you,
John. Thank you.
But isn't that so?
Right.
So, in other words, the administrative, I would call deep state, they are fighting back.
They are fighting back, and it's more than just the bureaucracies fighting back. The breadth of the federal government and the depth of its involvement in our everyday lives is the basic project of progressivism for more than a century now. Mm-hmm. And that requires a kind of loosening of traditional rights for property ownership and contract, and it implies that bureaucracies can take general laws and make them very specific. So the law says you can't pollute any body of navigable water. At some point, the Interior Department decides, or one of the departments decides, that digging a little pond in a highland area in Montana, which is not part of a wetlands, affects navigable water. Why? Because all water is ultimately flows into some river somewhere. And what Kavanaugh and people like that are trying to say is, if the law explicitly allows these kinds of regulations, then that's fine, unless it's unconstitutional. But if the law is a broad general law and not specific, and the bureaucracies start, in effect, legislating, that goes too far. The Congress has to say what it really wants. That's what our Constitution said. And that, I think, is going to be the big issue. You'll hear a lot about Roe, and Roe is important, but I think that this goes to the very heart of the progressive agenda. They know it. That's why they're pushing back.
But wouldn't Roe even fall into that category? I mean, it's one of those things where people say it's out there, but the states ultimately are going to make their own rules on it and make their own laws on it. So I think they're almost one and the same, and people are just blinded by the idea that it's a woman's issue. It's only the women. We're ruling against women. In reality, it's we're ruling, but not really. You know, it's leaving it up to dangling in the wind.
That's exactly right. The original Roe ruling, if you talk to lawyers, including those who very much favor, you're laughing and nodding your head, John.
How many law professors at the University of Chicago or elsewhere will politely and quietly tell you that it was a ridiculous reasoning? I mean, in terms of the law itself.
Right.
But politically, Jeff, which is why, Jeff, it's why I, and what Charles just said, it's why I want people to come back to federalism.
I think that, that's a very interesting point. And I think if the presidency and the Congress and the courts are in Republican hands, all of a sudden you will see liberal Democrats supporting federalism. And oddly, the Republicans say, oh, no, this is a federal matter.
Oh, we need big state to protect us.
Right. Well, you saw that in Arizona a few years ago. Remember when Obama wanted to have very loose border controls, and Arizona wanted tighter ones, and the courts ruled, look, immigration is a federal law, even if the federal government is not enforcing the laws that are on the books. It's not up to the states to do that. And I think that this will be, you put your finger on, this will be a big fight and an important fight. And I think...
Then I'll finally find something with that I can agree with Democrats on. Reducing the size of the federal government, the scope of the central authority, starving the Leviathan a little bit.
Why do you think that's good, John?
Because I think, Professor, we're fighting. We're at the point now where people are fighting over stuff and they don't even know why, which is why this ridiculous show, This Is Us, is part of this mix. We're so emotional. We're so up. We don't know. We don't know. Most people, unfortunately, did not have the benefit of a good reading list when they were in high school, including civics. They don't see it. They don't see what's happening. If we reduce the size of the federal government, we might be able to have a compromise understanding and not be at each other's throats, which is what our founders thought.
What you say is so important, and it goes back to this when you sort of switch topics to this, why is everybody at each other's throats? The one of the core concepts of a pluralist liberal system is that there are people with different interests, preferences. It's just a diverse society. It's multicultural and multi-interest in a good sense.
Yeah.
And the more you try to have a one-size-fits-all law, you're going to end up squeezing people who feel like, well, gee, we're a Catholic organization and we run a hospital. Why can't we decide that we won't provide abortifacients? This is against our faith. And for years, that was fine. If you wanted to get one, go to a different hospital. Right. But as soon as the federal government is paying a lot of the medical care costs, then all of a sudden the government has to make a rule. And the one rule will end up, no matter what it is, if it says you have to, and that's gonna, there are going to be people morally object. If it says you don't have to, there are going to be women who say, well, what about me? So the way that you live together in a society like this is, first of all, by respecting other people having different views and different opinions, and by allowing different states, different localities to have greater say over the way that they will make laws, and ultimately allowing individuals. I mean, we don't even talk, for example, John, Jeff, we don't even talk about minimum wage. To the extent that we talk about minimum wage, we all don't want to see poor people made worse off. We want to see them better off. I think that there's almost general total agreement about that. But assume that you're an adult and that I'm an adult. You're the employer. I'm the potential employee. And there's nothing secret in the thing that the government could say, oh, you're using a chemical that could affect me. It's just flipping hamburgers. I'm an adult. It's the best job I can get. You're an employer. It's the you're looking for. I'm the best employee you can get for the money, and you want to pay me X dollars, whatever it is. We now have rules that say you can't do that unless that's above a certain amount. Now, the people who put that in there had only, let's say, the best intentions. Let's assume that. Some did, some didn't. But let's assume that they did. But what we have is a voluntary agreement that's been interfered with. And And as soon as that happens, everybody's going to say, well, we can start interfering with all kinds of voluntary agreements to impose our preferences on these two other people. So John Cass can come in and effect a bargain between Jeff and Charles. Now, there's some we would allow that. We don't want cocaine being sold on the street. But the question is, should that be just every darn thing, or how limited should that scope be? We've got to have that discussion. We really do.
Well, perhaps we will. And I hope we will have this discussion again. Thank you so much for being here, sir.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank Jeff, you. It's a pleasure to talk with you. John, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
I've always wanted you here, and I've always wanted to just sit down and talk to you, with you, and I'm so glad, and I hope we could do it again.
I would love to do that, and I've got to say, your column is one of the joys in the Tribune. It really is.
One of the holes in the Tribune is that you're no longer writing for it. For Jeff Carlin, I'm sorry, let's start again. For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, the University of Chicago, thanks so much for being here. For Jeff Carlin, my sommelier friend, and for me, John Cass, this has been another edition of the Chicago Way.